As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and on today's episode, we will not be joined by Ryan Bailey, so I want to get this bit out of the way up front. Here we go. England is the most important game, certainly more significant than Italy beating Spain. Gareth Southgate should be knighted, occasional shortcomings in spite of. Important stuff now addressed. Let's move on to the match that was blessed. Italy pressed, Spain went on the attack, but the Azzurri pulled ahead when La Furia Roja did not track back. The Spanish got their equalizer, but it wasn't to be, despite a miss in the shootout from Locatelli. Morata scored and then missed his pen and maybe wishes he'd been at home watching in his den. The lack of further England chat might make Ryan toss his toys out the pram, but we probably shouldn't care about that. Isn't that right, Graham?
Definitely not. I mean, that was the best Ryan Bailey impression I've ever heard. I'm not sure how many I've actually heard, but that was definitely the best one.
Yeah, I was hoping to avoid England chat entirely, and then I remembered that we probably sort of have to preview them, so I won't go too much into that one. But how has the England viewing been over there? How much of this game was focused on England instead of the actual game?
Oh, goodness. Oh, no. It has reached a fever pitch over here, and I'm not kidding. Every single halftime break, the build-up. It was 7 minutes. I decided to time it today. I literally timed it on a stopwatch on my phone, how long it would take of the pre-match show for this game. A major tournament semi-final between Italy and Spain, like the two of the biggest footballing nations you could have, and it took them 7 minutes to turn the discussion towards England. Half-time, there was, I kid you not, there was a package about with Luke Shaw talking about apparently the lucky slippers that he wears. That is 100%. Oh, I'm not making that up. That's what. And then it was a discussion about Luke Shaw and Raheem Sterling at halftime of like the most, I thought, potentially or possibly one of the games of the tournament. This was, and they're talking about that at halftime. Oh my goodness, it's madness.
Graham, what I picture is, like, you know when you get that phone call from, like, it's usually work-related, maybe it's not, maybe it's, like, a person you haven't heard from in a while, but you know there's a reason they're calling, and so you have to do the kind of couple minutes of, like, hey, how you been? I've been well. How are you doing? Doing well. So what can I do for you? Like, that's what I picture this coverage being, is sort of just waiting until they get to talk about England, and then away they go. Is that about the vibe of it?
Yes, absolutely. You can tell that they just can't wait to talk about, Mason Mount's favourite Pixar films, or whatever.
And a man who has strong opinions about Pixar films is Joe Lowry. Joe, I'm done with rhyming, so I'm just going to ask how you're doing today, buddy.
Taylor, I'm doing great. It's so great to be back. I have my lucky slippers on. I just finished my second viewing of The Incredibles and The Incredibles 2. I'm on to Ratatouille. Let's do this thing.
I appreciate the Ratatouille. I appreciate the Patton Oswalt. I do find myself very much enjoying Moana these days.
Yeah.
And I watched the original Aladdin for the first time and appreciate that Disney now basically just has an apology in the front of that one. That's pretty phenomenal. Graham, you've got small children. What's the Pixar Disney animated thing of choice over there?
So my wife is desperately trying to get Sophie, that's my daughter, into Moana, because I think we're both quite keen on Moana. Moana's got good songs, doesn't it? And it's got The Rock. Yeah. And I mean, my unpopular opinion is Moana's better than Frozen. I know these aren't, that technically they're not Pixar films, they're Disney films, aren't they? But
I suppose.
Yeah, that's my view, and you can't change my mind.
You will get no arguments from me, my friend. So we will all agree on Moana. Joe, I won't even ask you. Joe, you can talk about Moana if you want to.
No, I also like Moana, and I think I agree, Graham. I think it might be better than Frozen. I do wonder though, Taylor, what percentage of our audience is here to hear us talk about Pixar or Disney animated films? I'm guessing it's extremely high.
I mean, Spain fans might prefer that we continue to talk about it. I don't know. Yeah, you're right, Joe. Let's talk about today's game. We had Italy versus Spain. We had an exciting but goalless first half. We had two goals, one apiece in the second half. Then we had a penalty shootout. Joe, let's start at the beginning, as we are wont to do. What did you make of the basic approaches for this game? Because I was pretty surprised when I saw the Spanish lineup as I messaged the group. I thought there was a chance this was a back five, and those silly apps, the lineup apps, got this one wrong. And instead, it was indeed Oyarzabal up top. It was Dani Olmo central. I wasn't expecting that. I'm guessing you weren't either, but what did you make of that Spanish approach?
I certainly wasn't expecting it, and I didn't really know what it was going to look like, Taylor, because you're talking about we weren't sure maybe Oyarzabal is going to be inside and maybe it'll be Olmo and Ferran Torres out wide. Yeah, I never know how to pronounce that.
No, I mean, you nailed it. You nailed it.
I wrote it down phonetically and not at all how he actually spells it, so that's my trick on that one. But I wasn't sure what this team was going to look like, right? The midfield, we were pretty sure. Busquets as the six, Pedri to his left, Koke to his right. That's written in stone at this point in the tournament. And the back four, also pretty standard stuff from Luis Enrique. So really, it is that forward line. When Alvaro Morata gets dropped, and ultimately it's Dani Olmo playing as that false nine, I thought it worked brilliantly for Luis Enrique. Yes, Spain lose this game, but Dani Olmo did a fantastic job of dropping into little spaces behind Jorginho, or pulling Jorginho to a side, or pulling Bonucci or Chiellini out of the middle of Italy's back four. I thought the move really, when we saw it being played out, and of course it's theoretical, in hindsight we have this advantage, but I thought it made a lot of sense from Luis Enrique to have a more mobile central forward in there in Dani Olmo versus Alvaro Morata. You have Olmo, who's quicker, he can pull those players out more directly. Morata can do some of that stuff, and he does do some of that stuff, drifting and dropping, and we saw that when he came on, and we saw that in the build-up to his goal. But Olmo just does everything like half a step faster, and he just plays with this little bit of chaos in his game that Alvaro Morata doesn't have when he drops. And so against an Italy team who is trying to get forward and is trying to use the ball, even though they didn't have a ton of possession in this game, having a player like Olmo who can take advantage of the gaps in their shape, in Italy's shape, I think it made a lot of sense. And I give Luis Enrique credit for making that choice. And it's a tough choice in a really big game, and I think it paid off even though Spain didn't win this game.
I entirely agree with you, including of your assessment about Dani Olmo, because he's one who we've seen at club level, we've seen him in this competition, but I don't think many Spanish attackers have really stood out as being like, yep, that's the guy that's going to lead that line. But I see why Dani Olmo could have been that player for Spain and was on the day, because he draws tons of fouls, he creates tons of problems, he causes massive headaches for Italy. Graham, I feel like we're doing the thing that podcasts sometimes do of talking about the defeated opponent at greater length than the victor, because I think people tend to focus on like, why didn't they win? What went wrong? And I'm kind of okay with that here, because I think the general feeling from our like quick chat before recording is that Italy won, but like maybe Spain deserved it more, even though deserve has nothing to do with it when it comes down to the result. But Spain, I think, pretty impressive in a way that I wasn't sure they would be in this game.
Yeah, I liked a lot of what I saw from Spain. And the irony in this is probably the performance I come away from thinking the highest of Spain in this whole tournament. And obviously their tournament has just ended. And watching this match, there was just so much. I mean, I can hear the excitement in Joe's voice talking about some of the tactical stuff that was happening in this game. And I just envisage you, Joe, taking notes like the Kermit on the typewriter GIF. furiously typing. Oh, Danny almost played as a false nine, and they're man-marking Jorginho and Verratti out of the game, so Donnarumma's having to go into them long, and his distribution is quite poor. And there was a lot happening, and it felt like Enrique got a lot of things right. It feels like, as I say, I'm kind of repeating myself a little bit. It feels like maybe the result was slightly wrong, but the thing that has obviously knocked them out is the trend that has been all the way through the tournament for Spain, is that they didn't convert their chances, or rather in the first half, a lot of their territorial advantage and their possession advantage. I think they had 70% possession over the full 90 or the 120 minutes. It didn't translate into that many golden opportunities. In fact, despite the fact, this is where this match was a bit of a paradox, despite the fact that I liked so much of Spain's performance for the first 70 minutes or whatever it was until they lost the goal, it wasn't really until Morata comes on that they start to create some opportunities. And so that's the bit I'm struggling to get my head around a little bit, because that seems the wrong way around.
It does. And I'm with you on everything you said, including being a little bit confused about it in the end. Joe, like, as Graham said, we have a Spain team dominating possession, not creating many clear-cut chances. And we've seen that many times in this tournament. This did feel different to me, though. And I'm wondering if it did for you as well. I don't think it was just because it's a semifinal and it's Italy and it's really exciting. It felt like there were those kind of familiar summary lines when it comes to Spain, but I felt like they were much more threatening, or maybe threatening in the way they probed and tried to pull Italy apart. And if anything, I came away from this, at least at the half, thinking it shows you how good Italians are at defending and how good this Italy team is at dealing with sort of unknowns and strange outliers. Because I think a lesser team, a less defensive team, a less disciplined team gets pulled out pretty easily, and Spain have a couple goals here and there. So I sort of feel like Spain did a lot of really good stuff. And though they might be painted with the same broad brush, it doesn't necessarily apply, or in my opinion, it doesn't apply at all here. Where are you on that one?
I think Spain, I agree with both of you guys. And Graham, you're talking about how this is kind of a hard one to wrap your head around. And Taylor, I agree with what you're saying as well in terms of Italy doing the baseline defensive thing, right? Doing the baseline defensive thing of not conceding a goal in the first half, where they were largely dominated by Spain. And I think for Spain in this game, they really gave off the impression for the first 45 minutes of the game, and then maybe 5 minutes into the second half, once things slowed down a little bit and settled into a rhythm. I think Spain wasn't just dominant in possession. They came up against a team in Italy who actually wanted to play a little bit and try to play out or over sometimes, but tried to play against Spain's high press. And that hasn't happened a ton for Spain in this tournament so far, at least certainly not in the group stage of this tournament. So Spain had a chance to flex some other muscles as well besides their repetitive possession muscle. They flex their pressing muscle, they flex their counter-pressing muscle, which they do in most games. But still, I think the things that they did in this game were a lot more, there was a lot more to it than just repetitive possession play. And I think that gave us the impression watching them of this team that was really dominant. And then you look at the stats at halftime, XG in a single game and certainly in a single half, not something we want to take as gospel here, but they had half of a goal. They had 0.5 XG to Italy's 0.06. So Spain wasn't creating an incredible number of chances, but they were keeping Italy to almost nothing. They hadn't had a shot until the almost very end of that first half, Italy, with, I believe it was Emerson who gets the shot off in the 45th minute or the 44th minute right before halftime. Spain really did do an excellent job of controlling the game, but in soccer, it's hard to say that's necessarily a good thing if you're not getting on the board. And when they go down 1-0, it was almost as if all of that control was for nothing.
Well, gentlemen, and I open this to either of you who has a thought, why do we think it was then that Spain couldn't get more opportunities? Because when I saw this lineup, as I said, I thought it was going to be in a back five. Graham, to his credit, I think correctly said, like, nope, this is probably what it's going to be. Maybe they'll be moved around a little bit, but this will be roughly the shape and the approach. And it was, which then led me to think, like, oh, okay, so Italy have basically played against more traditional hold-up number nines in this tournament. There was Seferovic for Switzerland. There was Lukaku for Belgium. I think you go back to their opening game, and Burak Yılmaz for Turkey. I forget who else was in the group, but that was one as well. The only time they haven't
Wales,
was...
Kiefer Moore.
Yeah, but he didn't play in that one.
Oh, he didn't. That was the final group game, yeah.
But that was sort of the Italy B team, and that was Aaron Ramsey central. And I thought, like, okay, so here's what it was. That's the game where they only got the one goal. They left it late, and Wales caused them problems, and that must be what they're doing. And then watching this game in the first 15 minutes, it became clear that it was more so that Spain just wanted the fluidity, knowing that they were going to have possession, knowing that Italy were going to be pressing them early and often, that they wanted to be able to move people around but have like kind of technical ability all over the pitch. And so I went from thinking this is not going to work to, wow, Spain are looking really, really good. But then as the game goes on, those chances don't come. So do either of you have theories on or ideas on why they weren't able to create more, why Spain couldn't find a way through until eventually they did when, as Graham said, they went with a slightly more traditional look?
I guess one of the things I expected a little bit more from Spain. So Dani Olmo, as we've mentioned a number of times, he was playing in the kind of central, I guess you would call it a false nine, as people tend to refer to it as. And what he was doing was he was dropping deep, and that was kind of confusing Bonucci and Chiellini, at least in my observation. And that was making compressing things in the centre of the pitch. But what I expected a little bit more of was someone like Ferran Torres. And I think you might have referenced this in our group chat, Taylor, during the game, was maybe Ferran Torres to have more awareness of when to make a run in behind. And I actually felt when Morata came on, for all his faults, he had more of a recognition of when to actually make that run in behind. And obviously there's a bit of link-up play with Olmo for the equaliser, so it's not a perfect analogy, because I'm more talking about Olmo positionally pulling someone out of that defensive line to create space for someone else to play a pass to Torres or Athabal. But Morata did recognise the fact that someone needed to be making those runs, and so I guess I expected more from Torres in particular, because that's something he tends to do. You know, he does that for City. We've seen that from him earlier in this tournament for Spain, coming off the bench and providing a little bit more forward thrust in that sense. And from the start, he's obviously started this match. I expected to see that from him, but it didn't really seem to happen.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Graham. I think Torres, in terms of his profile and how he plays as a more direct winger. At least that's how I think of him. And I know I've seen him do that role before, like you're talking about. But he was a player who I was also looking for more in this game. I think he is the right fit to make that run in behind, because if Olmo's dropped deep, there's space for someone to attack, you know, in the middle of Italy's defensive back four. So there's an opportunity for someone to break in behind. It's not going to be Pedri, right? It's not going to be Busquets. Those guys are much more of connectors, really, than they are of space exploiters in midfield. Koke made a run like the one that we're talking about that needed to be there. He made a run like that a couple of times. Oyarzabal made a couple of those as well, and he had a really nice run for that ball that comes in. I can't remember who plays the cross inside, but then he just whiffs on the header, right? It's Koke in the second half. Yeah, yeah. So it's a lovely sequence. If that header goes on frame, we might be talking about this game in a completely different way, right? So it is that run, but that also leads to the other point that I'm talking about. Yes, space was there to be exploited and maybe wasn't by Spain, but man, the margins are just so fine in a game like this, especially when you play like how Spain plays. A run that's a half step late, a run that's a half step early, a pass that's a half step. I mean, there's just so many pieces to this puzzle. And Spain didn't have maybe that one component that we've talked about with the run in behind, but there's also just so many other things. It has to be a mixture, a giant mixture of things that come off at the exact right time. And Spain maybe didn't have that today, even though I do think they looked really, really good in possession for much of this match.
Just going back to, sorry to jump in, Taylor, but going back to how this match was a real paradox for me. At the moment that Italy score their goal through Chiesa, I'm thinking that finally this match is, having watched Spain, I thought, be the better team up until that moment. When they score, I think this is now a match set up for this Italy team. They're going to drop their defensive line a little bit deeper. I think Mancini at that point, what's the change he makes? I'm trying to look through my notes. He puts on, I'm trying to look through.
Isn't it Berardi? Yeah, Berardi for Immobile.
Yeah, he puts on Berardi for Immobile, and normally that would be Chiesa for Berardi, or the other way around. And so to me, that just said Italy are going to go full counter-attack here. They're going to just sit and hit out in the counter-attack. And at that point, as I say, repeat myself a little bit, it's Italy's match. But no, that's the time when Spain, who are a team who have struggled to play through low defensive blocks this whole tournament, who have struggled for cutting edge and to take their chances, that's the moment when they decide to actually find the back of the net and score a goal. So that just added to my confusion of not really knowing what the hell was going on.
With Graham feeling a little bit confused, I know I am as well, and I feel like I need to practice my pronunciation of a certain player's name now that both of you have nailed it and I have very much done the opposite. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more goals, we'll talk a bit more about Italy, and we'll certainly talk about the penalty shootout in just a second. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back, listeners. Graham, since you mentioned his name, can we have a moment to talk about Chiesa, who scores the goal, your Italian son? The major question, the burning question we all have: do you reward your Italian son for scoring that goal with the, like, Italian cheek kiss? And do you do all the hugging and the kind of kissing on the cheek? Or is it more of a sensible handshake style celebration for you?
No, it's just the Italian hand gesture.
Just okay. Really, just really, each other and do it back
really,
and forth.
Really intensely. Yeah.
But Grim, that is a player, Chiesa, that you kind of hyped up a little bit before the tournament began. I know you were slightly frustrated to not have him featuring more, and yet here he is starting, going very, very, very late into this game, and then it seems like has maybe a little bit of a cramp, maybe feels something go, and so he pulls up, he comes out, but he does get that goal, and he did look very good. Overall thoughts on Chiesa from this one?
Yeah, I mean, first thing to say is I'm not sure I can get away with calling him my Italian son, given that his father is rather well known, Enrico Chiesa, who of course was a good footballer, a very good footballer in his own right.
Alleged father.
Yeah, but Chiesa, yeah, I did pinpoint him before the tournament. I think a lot of people did. I don't think I was alone in that. Berardi did start the first couple matches, and I could see why he did start those games. He had an importance in the structure. He stretches the pitch, he bursts to the byline a little more, gives Italy a little bit more width when they have Insigne on the other side to kind of cut in and congest things in the middle and link things up. However, I still couldn't shake the feeling that Chiesa just had that little bit of individual quality to make things happen. for Italy. And obviously we saw that in this game, and what a fantastic finish it is. I mean, he scores from the Lorenzo Insigne spot that we were talking about earlier in the tournament. But yeah, I'm a massive fan of Chiesa. I think what I like about Chiesa is throughout his tournament, he has been doubted and people seem to underestimate his ceiling as a player. So when he goes to Juventus, people say, oh, he's not good enough for Juventus. He starts the season quite poorly and people think he's out of his depth. Then all of a sudden he establishes himself in the first team. Then all of a sudden he is, I would say, towards the end of last season, Juventus' best player and the one who's making things happen for him. And it's kind of that narrative has continued into Euro 2020 where he's not in the team. Then he makes an impression with some good cameo appearances off the bench, and now you would say he's probably one of the first teams on the team sheet given how he's played in the last few games. So I'm pleased for him.
And I think made the difference certainly with getting that goal, but also I would say with the way he did so. Because earlier, Graham, you were talking about how when they score, you kind of expect Italy to sit in a little bit more, to do the defensive job and to frustrate and then try to maybe get the one on the counter. And I think in the build-up to this goal, Chiesa could have easily done that same thing and sort of jogged forward, got himself into position to support attack. But instead, he really sprints forward and is there to collect that loose ball and then has the tight control to get the shot off and get the goal. And that just felt like a good, I don't know, sort of representation of what Italy were doing in this game, which was doing things very well, but when that next level effort was required, they stepped up and made it happen. And I would say that's the case for this goal, but also just for the way they defended and sort of kept adjusting, because I think, as I said earlier, a lesser team gets pulled out and tracks Dani Olmo too far or gets stretched wide and then the gaps open up. And I think really the only time Italy opened up is when they end up conceding. Maybe the other one would be that sort of missed header that we already talked a little bit about. But I thought the way Italy defended, the way they were able to get that goal and then not sort of crumble when they concede the equalizer, I wasn't surprised that they didn't crumble, but simultaneously I just thought it was such a strong performance that showed how unified and well-coached that team is.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, to take it back a little bit to Chiesa, the thing that really strikes me about him is his conviction, and it almost hits me as Cristiano Ronaldo-esque. Obviously, he's playing alongside him at club level, so I wonder if a little bit of that has rubbed off on him. So when Donnarumma, who is it's him that launches the ball forward to Immobile, it is, isn't it? That kind of scrambles the ball further up the field. You know, Chiesa instantly knows that is a goal-scoring opportunity. And there was a dribble not long after that where sometimes you watch a player dribble and you think, oh, they're not really sure of what they're doing here. But it felt like he was purely in it to create a goal-scoring opportunity. And that's what I really like about him. And I think that conviction is throughout this Italian team. And you mentioned it there. They go to 1-1. It feels like the game plan is crumbling a little bit. But then, you know, Locatelli and who's the other one that comes on? Pessina come on in the centre of the pitch. And I just felt that was to inject a little bit of athleticism. I think Mancini recognised at that point it's really about matching the Spanish energy and matching any kind of runners. They'd already been done by Morata as the runner for the equaliser. So despite the fact Italy have played much, much better at this tournament, I even think they were maybe second best in this game in terms of what I liked about the performance. They still have enough of them about them on an off day, either in the structure that Mancini's put together or their individual quality, or to be honest, that great intangible that we talk about, the character of the group as well. And I do think that is important, and you have it in abundance in players like Chiellini and Bonucci and players who have been there and done it before. They still have enough to get through to the final. So if this is their low bar, there's almost a strength in their relative weakness, if that makes any sense.
It does. It definitely does. And I want to talk about that character as we get to the penalty shootout. First, Joe, I want to spend a little bit of time on the equalizer because it is Alvaro Morata. And as has been the case several times in the course of this game or in discussing this game, when Luis Enrique is forced to make some changes once they're trailing, the changes he does make to me felt like this isn't going to work. It seemed like they went with more of a 4-2-3-1. At one point, it's Rodri and Busquets as a double pivot. That didn't feel like it was going to create much. Moreno comes on, Morata comes on. And for a second there, it felt like, oh, he's kind of putting everybody in the exact same positions you would expect them to be. And this feels like it's going to go the way we expect it to, which is frustrating, half chances, but nothing clear cut. Italy win 1-0 or 2-0. And instead, it's, again, more fluid, more movement than I expected it to be. It's players moving off the ball. I think John Mueller did a really good job of breaking down the goal where it's Jorginho being pulled out and that opens up space for Morata, but Morata himself finding that little pocket is impressive. Joe, you've been sort of his advocate in this tournament. would you like to continue that now?
I mean, yeah, I would. I think Morata comes on and he plays a not a unique role, but he starts shifted out wide to the left, and Dani Olmo is still playing as that nine who's dropping in. And then Morata shifts inside more, and he's inside on the goal that he scores in the 80th minute. But then they swap some back and forth, and Morata still is in the left half space some, and Jordi Alba's pushing up wide on that left side. And so it is fluid. And ultimately, Spain were fluid as this game went on. And this goal was the best example of their fluidity. It's a gorgeous sequence. It's Laporte finding Morata, dropping into midfield. Pedri has pulled Jorginho out, like you're talking about, Taylor, referencing that John Mueller tweet, which is a great breakdown of it with good screen caps and all that jazz. And then Morata gets on the ball in between the lines, doing the thing that Spain were trying to do all game long. And it's funny that it comes with Morata doing the Dani Olmo thing instead of Dani Olmo doing it, even though he was, I mean, it's a role reversal here slightly. But then both of those players get involved in the goal. They move forward. Morata pulls Chiellini out and then plays the ball to Olmo. And then Olmo threads the ball into Morata, who scores. I guess I enjoy watching Alvaro Morata play. He's not a player that I'm always, 1,000% stoked to watch. He's not this Erling Haaland-esque light things on fire kind of number nine, but he's a good player and he certainly doesn't deserve all of the, I mean, crap isn't even putting it strongly enough. He doesn't deserve all the abuse that he's been getting from Spanish fans and from all fans in air quotes there, really. I mean, he doesn't deserve any of that stuff. And it's a shame. It is such a shame that he misses that penalty kick. I cannot even imagine in the penalty shootout what he's feeling right now as we're recording this. But he is a good striker who doesn't always finish his chances. But I mean, guess what, guys? No striker ever finishes all of their chances that they should finish, quote, again, air quotes there. I enjoy watching Alvaro Morata. I think I enjoy watching the Spain team more than most. And this fluid attacking movement was just gorgeous. And Taylor, before I flip it back to you, Pedri, come on. Pedri is so good. His movement, like we've already said, unlocks this opportunity for Spain to move forward. He didn't miss a pass. He didn't play an errant pass until, I think, the second to last minute of extra time. It's like the 119th minute, something like that, something insane like that. He is just unreal. And this is the coldest of all cold takes. This take has been swimming in the frozen tundra for a week straight. But he is phenomenal for Spain. And he will be their starting left center mid or maybe shifting over to the right. It doesn't matter. He will be in this team for a long, long, long time, and he will be key for Barcelona, and he will be key whenever Manchester City comes in and buys him for £200 million.
Yeah, so much so, less of the Man City thing, more so what he does for Spain, that I think as we got into extra time, you had Jorginho not quite man-marking him because that would have left too much space and that would have kind of played into their hands, but it was a constant head on a swivel check from Jorginho to make sure that that there was coverage there for Pedri, but then there was also coverage on Dani Olmo, and having to track those two players and all their movements.
It's a nightmare.
I think maybe there's an argument that Italy were welcoming those penalties because at least they didn't have to deal with that sort of discipline anymore. I would also say that, yes, Morata misses his penalty, but like, to some extent, I'm wondering if Italy had already won the penalty shootout before it began, because I'm guessing you all saw Giorgio Chiellini just like laughing it up. He lifts up Jordi Alba. He gives
him
a big
insane.
Old hug.
He's insane. He's crazy.
But Alba wasn't having any of it. He was not in the mood at all for any of it.
And I don't know who Spain's fifth taker would have been because they don't have one go, but I hope it was Jordi Alba because otherwise he is very locked in for not taking a penalty. But Chiellini, I can't tell if that was like I was wondering if he was going to take one and just bury it. He didn't end up taking one, but just the very relaxed smile, like, we've been here before. Isn't that crazy? Even Donnarumma, I think he has like a long embrace sort of nuzzle with Unai Simon. And again, it's that like, oh, can you believe we're here? Ha ha ha. And I think if you're going into a penalty shootout, you want there to be a genuine lighthearted positivity. You don't want that faux, like, we're all great, right? This is going to be wonderful. I'm not nervous. That doesn't strike the right tone. But I just felt like Italy had the kind of positivity there. And even when Locatelli misses the opener, and it's not a particularly good penalty, it's a great save, I would say, as well, from Simon. from there, it's just sort of they go about their business. They dispatch the next four and Italy into the final. Graham, any thoughts on the penalty shootout? I did my diagramming. I've got a few, but I wanted to throw to you and Joe first.
I'm not sure I'm that great at analyzing penalty shootouts. I feel that that's definitely your thing, Taylor. What are your thoughts on them? I feel like you must have something.
Joe, do you have any before I just sort of go on about my business?
Yeah, real quick. So I did watch large stretches of the last two games, the last couple of shows that I wasn't on. And I know a number of those games went to penalties. There have been just a ton of really bad penalty kicks in this tournament. And this goes all the way back to the group stage as well. There were stats going around about, you know, players missing just an obscene number of penalty kicks in this tournament. I mean, what's going on here, fellas? I'm not going to say it's easy to step up and hit a penalty, but like the first one from Locatelli is poor, and then Olmos is the second one, isn't it? It's the first one for Spain. He goes way high, way wide, and then Morata's
opener. Yep.
Yeah, and then Morata's penalty is dreadful. It's not a good penalty kick. That doesn't mean this is a terrible soccer player, blah, blah, blah. But it's not good. And so, Taylor, I don't know if you have an explanation for that or whatever you want to say, but that was kind of my takeaway from the shootout.
What happened was Manchester United and Villarreal used up all the converted penalties in
Graham.
The Europa League final. And so now we've got about 2 years of missed penalties because of that.
And now Taylor's sad.
I mean, no. Kind of always sad whenever Man United are involved. I have a half-baked theory on why maybe like the penalties haven't been so good. And it is that basically we've had so many games over the last season and a half because of the resumption after COVID, but it's meant, I think, more fatigue, maybe more sloppiness late, which lends itself to more maybe contact in the box, more penalties given up. And we have tons of footage of players. I think we have dedicated people on staff who track everything. And I will say that both keepers, Donnarumma guessed right 3 of 4 times and Unai Simon guessed right 3 of 5 times. And I believe Jorginho went the opposite way of where he tends to go. So I do wonder if maybe just the research that these goalkeepers are able to do themselves or have done for them makes it so that penalties get a little bit harder. I also think it's interesting that both times we've had a team go to penalties, the next time they go to penalties, it does not work out. And I think there is something to be said for overthinking, knowing that people have watched what you've just done. Because Dani Olmo steps up. He was the second taker last time, and he nailed his into the top left corner. This time he's the first taker. He misses it by aiming for the top left corner and hitting it over. And I think there's a chance that maybe there had been some footage watched, and there was a guess that he would go the same way.
It's that old thing, sorry to interrupt you, it's that old thing of when you're maybe forced to retake a penalty or you get two penalties in the same match and you think, are they going to go the same way? Are they going to do the same thing or are they going to shake it up? And I feel like as you reference here, you can almost like outthink yourself by trying to work out what you want to do.
And the only one who doesn't is Moreno, who went like almost, if you watch it again, the exact same spot in that top right corner. He just puts it down and hits it as hard as he can. And there's something to be said for that because then we look at Alvaro Morata and the one angle on the replay, Donnarumma is just staring at his face the entire time. From the moment he puts that ball down and stands up, Donnarumma is just staring at him until he starts his run up and Donnarumma is already basically moving to exactly where that kick is going. And I do think he read him completely throughout that one. So I think there were some moments like that where I thought Donnarumma just did an excellent job. I keep waiting for that second foot to come off the line and it is not happening. Even on the replays, you can see the foot's on the line the whole time. So I think it's a credit to the goalkeepers for figuring that one out and then not letting anything. Like, I really don't want there to be a save that then gets called back, basically.
So you're not blaming, like, the ball, because that's normally how this conversation goes, is it not? Like, the ball's lighter than usual.
Or whatever. No.
That's usually, like, the lazy pundit, like, cliche. Oh, the balls move all over the place. By the way, the ball in this game, I swear this wasn't a deliberate segue. The ball in this game, oh, fantastic. It's a new silver ball for the semifinals and final. It's Euro 2004 nostalgia. It's brilliant.
Fine, let's blame the ball then, since Graham liked it. I think it was definitely all the ball. It wasn't good finishing and confidence from Italy. Bonucci walking up, my note was, he either looks incredibly focused or incredibly nervous. And then it was just calm with three A's because he was very, very calm in his finish. I love that Thiago went for the hop and, like, I'm going to call it the Joseph Martinez hop and pass into the goal. I enjoyed somebody making the point that, of course, Thiago passes his goal.
An idea ball.
Yep. But then Jorginho does the exact same thing. And I like that as well. That is second only to the Panenka as a way to win a penalty shootout. That the calmness of that one and just slotting it in and then backing yourself and running off to celebrate. I thought it was a great penalty shootout, even if it wasn't a technically great penalty shootout, Joe.
Penalty kicks are just a giant psych experiment. And we're just watching. And so I don't know. I always get nervous watching it and it just feels so insane. And sports are crazy, man. Aren't they? You know? Yep. Wow. Wow. What a day.
Sports are crazy and Italy advanced. That feels about a good summary for this tournament so far. Anything else from this game, from Italy's win over Spain, before we move on to briefly discussing tomorrow's semifinal?
Yeah, I've got one thing quickly. We didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about Spain's press against Italy's buildup. But, I mean, we've mentioned how, and Taylor, you specifically have mentioned how Italy did a lot of things well in this game. And I largely agree with that. One thing that I don't think they did well at all in the opening 30, really in the first half, is play through Spain's press. They were not really consistent with their approach to building through it. And Spain pressed well, and they had oftentimes Pedri and Koke marking Jorginho and Verratti, or sometimes they had Olmo and Oyarzabal doing that job. And so I'm not saying Spain made it easy for them, but this is an Italy team that's been billed and largely has earned this billing as being this effective ball-dominant team. They really weren't that today. Their success came in transition. A lot of Spain's success really came in transition as well. I think for Italy, as they approach the final on Sunday, cleaning up their possession play, especially if they're playing Denmark, who I think will extend, and England might extend a little bit as well. But either way, they'll need to be more effective with the ball to give themselves the best possible chance of winning that final.
I haven't gone back and watched in enough detail, but my assumption would be that Spain did a ton of viewing of footage for Italy and identified the at least very obvious pressing triggers and then played into that so that Italy couldn't really get comfortable in what they wanted to do. I saw them trying to kind of crowd everybody onto one half of the pitch, either the right side or the left side. But when they would do that, there were moments when, because Spain did have some of the positional fluidity that we've already talked about, they couldn't close down a player fast enough. And if you have everybody on one side, Spain would just have it. It was oftentimes they would have the ball on their left. Azpilicueta on the right would just be standing far out on the right. And there would be enough time for that big switch over. And then Italy have to all shift to the other side. And I think at a certain point they recognized it wasn't as effective and they started to sit off a little bit more. And I think Spain basically nullified some of those triggers and Italy had to adjust. And I think whoever advances from England v. Denmark maybe would do well to watch some of that footage as well and spot some of those and see how they can use those to their advantage.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think, I don't know, I'm just excited for this final because I think no matter who the opponent is, it's going to be just a really tactically interesting game, and we can get into that more as the final approaches and all that good stuff. But yeah, I think, Taylor, I'm with you on that.
All right. Graham, I know it's late over there. Anything else to add on this one? Or are you ready to move?
I was just so psyched to see the tiny football car back.
Yes. Ryan is smiling.
Graham, was it you who was tweeting that it's been verified? It has a blue check mark on Twitter?
Yeah. I mean, if the fact that I've got a blue check mark wasn't already proof that they hand those out to anyone, the fact that the tiny football car from the Euros has a blue tick definitely proves that.
Hey, Graham. They don't hand them out to just anyone. I'm just saying. Sad face emoji.
Oh,
Total Soccer
great.
Show. One day we'll be verified. One day we will be a genuine show. But for now, we're just a fake soccer show, I think. We will be back to not talk more about verification. We'll instead talk about England v. Denmark in just a second. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Welcome back. Final segment, fellas. We've got a semifinal to preview. England v. Denmark. Graham, since you left us off talking about small, tiny cars, first of all, are you going to be sad if we don't get a small car wheeling the ball onto the pitch tomorrow?
Yes,
what if
absolutely.
What if we get like a small animal pushing not the silver ball? Will you be okay with that, or will you be sad because we had a double change?
Wait, so a small animal's pushing what? It's pushing not the silver ball. So what's it pushing?
What's your least favorite soccer ball? That one.
Right, okay. The gold one from the 2002 World Cup.
Perfect.
I wasn't too keen on that one. Don't ask
me
why.
So small animal trained to push the golden ball from 2002 versus this is the exact type of conversation we'd be having if Ryan were here. Graham, which one you want?
This would be a bizarre scenario. I'd have a lot of questions if the 2002 World Cup ball came out on the back of a small animal onto the Wembley pitch.
All right, well, I think that's England-Denmark previewed, unless you all have any other thoughts. Joe, I won't ask you about cars. I'll just ask you, is there anything in particular you are going to be watching for, you're excited about between England and the Danes tomorrow at 3 p.m.?
I'm curious to see how England are going to set up in this game, right? They've done some shape mirroring in this tournament after really starting out in a 4-3-3 shape with Calvin Phillips and Mason Mount ahead of Declan Rice. That's how they began this tournament. And then Calvin Phillips's positioning has been tweaked some. Mason Mount obviously has been out of the lineup due to coming in contact with Billy Gilmore. Sorry, Graham. So we've seen some tweaks from Gareth Southgate. That's just one slight example. He's done some tinkering from game to game. And so I'm wondering and kind of expecting to see this 3-4-3 shape matched up against Denmark's 3-4-3 shape, right? Denmark have Mikkel Damsgaard and oftentimes Braithwaite tucking inside and playing underneath that number nine. It's been Dolberg recently. Could be Josef Paulsen playing that number nine role if he's back in the starting 11 for Denmark. But I'm curious to see how England are going to approach this game. How do they try to defend Denmark? Are they going to try to do what they did against Germany, where they really do match up man for man? And if so, how will Denmark tweak things? Germany dropped Kai Havertz into central midfield a lot of the time in that game to create some sort of numerical advantage or disadvantage in certain areas for England. What will Denmark do to counter all of England's tactical tweaks if indeed Gareth Southgate does make those tweaks?
Graham, let's talk about Scotland, and I mean that sincerely, because Scotland were able to hold on to the nil-nil draw, and they did some things very intelligently against England. Do you think that is a game that Denmark could be looking at as a way to frustrate England, to sort of nullify the many attacking threats they have, and then maybe potentially counter a bit more effectively and sneak a goal? Do you think that they could kind of go that more defensive route?
I mean, it sounds strange to suggest that Denmark, who are in the semi-finals of a major tournament, might be looking at Scotland for a game plan. But yeah, I guess so. Surely they will have. I mean, Scotland are so far the only team to have stopped England from scoring. I guess that in terms of their system, I mean, the way that they're likely going to use a back five with wing backs, there are similarities between how Denmark play and how Scotland set up. Obviously, they just do it a lot better than we do. And switching on to kind of what Joe was talking about there with how England have made changes to match up at this tournament, I look at this Denmark team and I see a team that is eerily quite similar in terms of their makeup and their tactical approach to Germany when England did match up against them. You know, they play with wingbacks that like, particularly with Milo on the left side, who they like to create an overload there. They have two central midfielders who will try to control the game in Delaney and Højbjerg. And then they have kind of a fluid front three, which is similar to how Germany had, you know, Werner and Havertz and Müller. You know, in Denmark's case, it's Damsgaard, Dahlberg and Braithwaite. I think Hjulmand will probably stick with those three, despite the fact Poulsen is fit. So I fully expect England to match up. And I think Denmark, for me, a lot of this game will be decided in that midfield battle, because I think it will be a 2-on-2 scrap between Phillips. Scrap's not the wrong word, because I think it will be, it is the wrong word, because I think it will be very technical and a lot about the use of the ball. But Phillips and Rice versus Delaney and Højbjerg, I think that will determine a lot of this match. You would ordinarily assume that England, with their superior quality, will dominate a match like this. But Højbjerg and Delaney are arguably playing at higher standards than Rice and Phillips. I know Rice and Phillips are young and will probably have higher ceilings, but you know, they're players with good pedigree and are used to the big events, and they won't be overawed. And I just think one of the things I took away from the Scotland game was just how Billy Gilmore had the conviction and the confidence in himself to kind of say, I'm going to dominate this game a little bit in the centre of the pitch. And I think Denmark, and with Højbjerg in particular, have a player who can do that.
And I want to add, Grim, you're talking about that 2v2. I think we could see Andreas Christensen do his thing where he shifts in from right center back spot or somewhere in the back three and then tucking into midfield. And that could be the Kai Havertz of this game. That could be the thing that Kasper Hjulmand does to unbalance England's shape and give them an advantage in a key area. We've seen Christensen move into midfield before. That could be a move that Hjulmand makes to just tweak things a little bit and try to unbalance England in possession. Also, I mean, Damsgaard moving inside. We've seen that earlier in this tournament, almost forming a diamond. If Christensen moves inside, Damsgaard tucks inside from left wing, then they have four players in there with Delaney and Højbjerg. So that could be a really nice midfield diamond or midfield rhombus, or whatever you want to call it, in this game for Denmark, who is just an incredibly good team. I don't really view them talent-wise, yes, they're at a deficit, but tactically, they've been excellent in this tournament. Technically, they've been excellent in this tournament. I think they have everything they need to really give England a game.
And I think we've talked about it previously, but that back line, very, very solid. The midfield ahead of them, also pretty solid. Mela has been, if not for Spinazzola, one of the kind of standout left wing backs of the tournament, which is a strange thing to say, but there have been many, many strong performances in that spot in this competition. So then my final question for both of you, Graham, I apologize, I'm going to make you answer this. Is there a thing you would like to see from England, be it a back three or a back four, or is there a specific player you think puts them in a better situation?
I would like to see them forget to field 11 players and only play six by accident. That's what I would like to see from them. But I feel like the chances of that are minimal.
I mean, all right, but we'll definitely note that. I think it will be somewhat obvious. So that aside, Graham, of fielding only six players, is there, like, do you want it to be Saka? Would you like it to be Sancho? Do you not much care and just kind of want to see what their overall approach is to deal with a Danish team that I think has proven themselves to be pretty tricky?
Yeah, just through pure personal preference, I would quite like to see Sancho again, just because obviously we haven't seen much of him at this tournament, and I don't want to be left kind of wanting more, which obviously he was very good against Ukraine, and so I just want to see a little bit more of him. I know Saka has had a good tournament as well, but I just like the threat of Sterling off one side, Saka off the other, and Kane in the middle. It feels like if I were an opposition player, I would be more daunted by that than Saka. Despite the fact Saka is very good and he's had a great tournament, I still think Sancho has more about his game. I personally would like to see Sancho. To be honest, other than that, I think there's not going to be many surprises. I know Southgate has chopped and changed and there's been a few surprises early in the tournament. I'm looking at Trippier at left back for the opening game of the tournament, which I still think was strange. But other than that, I think he has settled on, if he goes to a back three, we know what players he's going to play in what position because he did that against Germany. If he plays a back four like he's done in the other matches, we know what players are going to play in what position. So really, for me, it's Saka or Sancho, and that's really the only decision he has to make.
All right, so it's England starting with only six players, then it's will he start Phil Foden at centre-back, and then the thing you'll be paying attention to, is it Saka versus Sancho?
Yeah, that nailed it. That's it.
All right, perfect. What about you, Joe?
I'd love to see Phil Foden at centre-back. That is now just catapulted to the top of my England wish list. Now, I mean, genuinely, I'd like to see... This won't happen, right? I'm being very clear here. This won't happen. I'd like to see England play. I'd like to see them let loose a little bit and do their thing. But that is, I mean, that's like saying I want to see Spain defend in a low block for 90 minutes, right? It's just not going to happen. It's completely against Gareth Southgate's tactical identity. And that's fine. His tactical identity works. So what I'm expecting to see from England tomorrow is I'm expecting to see them play pretty conservatively. They're likely going to have at least some of the ball, and they're not going to get dominated in terms of possession. They're going to be able to put their foot on the ball in moments, but I'd like to see them actually take chances and take risks and drive forward. I think they'll end up playing more horizontally, a little bit slower, but it's worked for them in this tournament. It's been a hugely effective recipe for them using the ball as a defensive mechanism, not taking too many chances, just controlling the game with careful possession. And so if they're going to do that, I'd at least like to see the Czech Republic version of England, where they're playing the Czech Republic and the Czech Republic step high and they really do press England early on in that game. And then England, when they're being forced to do something with the ball, when the opposing team is coming to meet them, like I think Denmark will at times, then they have to go. They have to either play the ball long, which is maybe not the highest percentage option, or they have to play through pressure. And boy, they have the talent to play through pressure. So I'd really like to see, I don't much care who the personnel is necessarily, because there's talent no matter what, but I'd like to see Phil Foden leading, you know, counterattacks from his center back spot. Now, I'd like to see them using the ball to break through a press or to break through Denmark somehow tomorrow. And I do think that's possible. I don't think I'm asking Gareth Southgate to go against his tactical philosophy. So I think there's a chance we could see England put out a few nice bits of combination play and a few nice bits of build-up against Denmark tomorrow.
I'd like to see Luke Shaw play in his slippers. And I'd also like to see Mason Mount celebrate a goal by lifting up his shirt to reveal a Ratatouille shirt underneath as well.
Well, if either of those things happen, I'm sure you will both be back to discuss them. Ryan Bailey will also be joining us from England. I don't know what his sobriety level will be. I think it will very much depend on the result, but that's at 3 p.m. We'll have that show out tomorrow evening. For now, gentlemen, it's time to say goodbye. And since it's me doing it and not Ryan Bailey, here we go. Joe, it is very lovely to have you back. We missed you. It's always fun to have you providing the analysis and the excellent work, the tactical and the impressive thoughts overall. Joe, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Taylor, man, you're so welcome. It's great to be back. You did a great job hosting, as you always do. It's been lovely. It really has.
And Graham, good stuff.
Thanks, man.
Listeners, thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you again very soon.